Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcast.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey y'all, I'm your host Mark Covey, and this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case I have for you today is about a young man who was murdered as a result of what police thought was a love triangle turned deadly. But when they looked a little deeper, they uncovered a twisted web of lies spun by everyone involved, except for the man who was murdered. This is the case of Brian Barrett. Around 9 in the morning on Sunday, September 17th, 2006, a man doing a routine check of the parking lot where he worked in Clarence, New York. He works for Dynabraid, which is a power tool manufacturer, and even though the factory was closed on the weekends, he still goes around making sure nothing was out of place. While doing his check, he sees a white pickup truck sitting in the otherwise empty parking lot. He walked up to it because there aren't supposed to be any vehicles parked here today. But when he comes to the driver's side door, he stops in his tracks. The window is rolled up and there are three large bullet holes in the upper right-hand corner. And in the driver's seat, he sees the body of a young man slumped over. This young man is covered in blood, clearly not breathing. So the guy who found him runs to find a phone and called 911. When police arrived, it's obvious that they're dealing with a homicide. When they open the trunk, they can see that the young man was shot multiple times, and since most of all of the blood is dry, he's likely been dead for at least a full day or maybe even more. His wallet with his ID is right there in the truck, so they learn that the man's name is Brian Barrett. He's a 22-year-old. In an article for the Buffalo News, they find out that he's a part-time employee there at the factory. And when they get in contact with management, they are told his last shift was on Friday evening, which makes them think that he was more than likely killed that same night. As the investigators analyze the crime scene, there are a few things that stick out to them right away. They can see that the rear passenger tire is completely flat, like to the point where it would be nearly impossible to drive on. I don't believe it was slashed. None of the crime scene photos make it look like it was cut. It honestly just seemed like the air was just let out. Nearby, they find three bullet casings for 30 caliber ammo, as well as a gun clip and a peach pit. So right away, investigators at the scene start kind of piecing together what might have happened based on these clues. There's no way Brian could have driven to work on that flat tire, at least not safely. So they think that whoever killed him probably let the air out while Brian was working. So when he came out, he couldn't drive away, which indicates that this wasn't just a random act of violence. This was planned. The investigators gather up the ammo, the clip, and the peach pit, and they sent all of it off to their forensic lab in hopes that they'll be able to get fingerprints for some type of DNA. During my research, I couldn't find anything on security footage in the parking lot, which I assume means there wasn't any or if there was cameras, they didn't capture the footage of the crime. After they wrap up the crime scene, investigators go to inform Brian's parents of his death. Of course, they're devastated and completely shocked that something like this could have happened to their son. His parents say they have no idea who could have done this because, as far as they know, their son was well-liked and didn't have any enemies. And he's not into drugs and didn't drink a lot. I mean, he's a 4-year college student studying to be a teacher and working part-time at the factory. So it's not like he had a lot of time to be getting into trouble anyways. When they talk to Brian's friends and his co-workers at the factory, they tell a slightly different story. Brian's co-workers tell police that he got along with almost everyone, except for a man named Thomas Montgomery. And the reason why he and Thomas didn't get along is kind of a tangled story, but I'll give you the cliff notes. So Thomas has been going around and bragging to people at work about this girl that he was dating. Apparently, they met in an online game chat room, which was all the rage back in the early 2000s. Mind you, Thomas was fully married and had 2 kids, but it didn't stop him messaging an 18-year-old girl who went by the name Tall Hot Blonde, and it also didn't stop him from telling anyone who would listen about it. But a few months ago, he tells his co-workers that he and the girl broke up. Now, I'm sure he just wanted to leave it at that, but here's where all of the beef with Brian comes in, because Brian goes around telling everyone the real reason they broke up. It turns out that Brian and Thomas played the same online game, so they were in the same chat room with the same girl. So Brian, or Beefcake as he was known online, knew this girl as well. To be clear, the majority of Thomas and Tall Hot Blonde's messages were in a private chat room, but after they broke up, she confided in Brian, who then went and told everyone what she told him, which was that Thomas, who went by the name Marine Sniper, had been pretending to be 18 like she was. So she broke up with him as soon as she found out that he was actually 46 with a family. So Thomas was pissed that Brian told everyone about his lie. And according to reporting for the Lockport Union Sun and Journal, he was even more pissed when everyone found out that Brian and Tall Hot Blonde were now dating. Now, messy love triangles like this are always a red flag for investigators, but they're even more concerned when they learn that Thomas has a bit of a violent streak. In fact, he's even bragged to one of his co-workers about the type of gun he would use if he was ever going to kill someone. And the gun he mentioned was a kind that used the same caliber ammo as the bullets that killed Brian. So after police learned all of this, the next thing they wanted to do is talk to him and figure out where he was on Friday around the time they think Brian was killed. But there's one problem. They can't find him. He's not at home, his wife doesn't even know where he is. And speaking of his wife, she tells him that she's aware of the girl online, whose name she says is Jesse, and she's not planning on divorcing him because of his online infidelity. But this was super concerning to police, because if he was the one who killed Brian, it seems like he had the motive, then he could be going after Jesse next. So they need to find her.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
From talking to everyone so far, they learned that she lives somewhere in West Virginia, but they aren't sure where. Now, they don't have access to Thomas's devices right now because they don't have a warrant, so they can't go look into his digital logs and track Jesse. But if you remember, Brian was in the same chat talking to the same girl. so they think maybe using his computer could help lead them to her. When they look at their messages, they find a lot of standard lovey-dovey stuff that you would expect between two young people in a long-distance relationship. But they also find some really disturbing messages from Jessie to Brian, that she told Brian that Tom was making all kinds of threats to her about hurting Brian. And there's another message to Jessie where Brian admitted that Thomas had tried to hit him with his car in the parking lot at work. He wondered if he should tell his boss or someone just to be safe. Now, I couldn't find when these messages were sent, but from their messages, it's clear that both Brian and Jessie were afraid of Thomas. But that's not all. They also find some private messages between Thomas and Brian a few months before Brian's murder. Jessie had apparently invited Brian to come meet her in person in West Virginia, but Brian was still a little hesitant, which he told Thomas, and Thomas then said, quote, "I can't believe you chose her over our friendship," end quote. And then he went on to use multiple expletives and racial slurs when talking about Jessie and the harm he wished towards her. All of these messages solidify police's belief that Jessie is in danger, so for the next few hours, they try to track her down. And finally, one of the officers is able to find her MySpace page with her full name, so they use that to figure out her address and then contact the closest agency in Oak Hill, West Virginia, to do a wellness check. According to a documentary called Tall Hot Blonde, two officers in West Virginia are dispatched to the house at about 6 in the morning on Monday the 18th. This is just the day after Brian was found. When they knocked on the door, a middle-aged woman answers. They ask her if her name was Jessie and she says, "No, my name is Mary. Her daughter's name is Jessie, but she doesn't live at home." The officers ask her if she has any way of getting a hold of her daughter and she says, "No." But officers are kind of taken aback by this. They're like, "Okay, you really don't have a phone number, you don't have an address, you have nothing." And they even press, like, they tell Mary that Jessie might be in danger. After this, Mary started to get noticeably nervous. And they keep pressing her for a while to get, like, any contact with her daughter. And she gets more and more uncomfortable. She finally breaks down crying, and through the tears, she tells officers something I don't think anyone expected. Mary admits to officers that her daughter Jessie isn't the one who's been messaging Brian and Thomas. She was. She says it's all been her using her daughter's name and photos online to pose as an 18-year-old girl. Mary tells them that neither her husband or daughter had any idea she's been doing this. And the people she fooled online had no idea either. She's basically been catfishing both Thomas and Brian for a year. She actually told them that Thomas actually called her house late Friday evening and, thinking she was Jessie, told her that her boyfriend was easy to take care of. They have her fill out a police report where she explains everything, and since she's not the real Jessie, they don't think she's in any immediate danger. So the officers leave, but they still need to find Thomas. And it doesn't take them long because at some point, he returns home and the police in New York find him around 6:30 that same morning, getting ready to leave for work. When they approached him, the investigators make it clear that he's not under arrest and technically they don't have any evidence to tie him to the crime. But they would like him to come into the station to answer a few questions, which he agrees to. However, right away, the investigators can tell that it's not going to be easy to get this guy to talk. Thomas immediately denies having anything to do with Brian's death. And the more they press him, the more erratic his behavior becomes. His mood seems to flip out of nowhere. He'll be calm one second, and then the next, he is completely outraged and yelling at investigators. But even though his erratic mood swings are red flags, they can't actually get him to admit anything. He does talk a little bit about his online relationship with Jessie, but he doesn't say anything incriminating either. And investigators decide to withhold the information about Jessie actually being 40-something-year-old Mary and they do this mostly for Mary's protection. But after a few hours of talking, they don't have anything that they can hold Thomas on, so they let him go. But they do get a warrant to search his house and confiscate both his computer and his car that same day. The big thing they're looking for is a murder weapon, and he does own multiple guns that he keeps in a gun cabinet. But according to more reporting for the Buffalo News, they can't find a weapon that uses the same caliber ammo that was found at the scene. But they do find a handbook for a 30 caliber gun. But Thomas denies actually owning one. He said that he just had the handbook because he's always wanted one, but other than the handbook, they find nothing. I know all of this was like crazy to take in, but I do want to touch on Brian's autopsy for a quick second. It was performed a few days after he was found. The pathologist finds that Brian died of 3 gunshot wounds, one to the chest, one to the arm, and one to the neck. The killer did in fact use 30 caliber ammunition, which matches both the shell casing found at the crime scene and the type of ammo that would fit in the clip they found. And if you remember, it also happens to be the right caliber for the type of gun Thomas told a coworker he would use to kill someone. But other than the gunshot wounds, the pathologist doesn't find anything else on Brian's body that would help identify his killer. Over the next month and a half, the investigators spend hours poring over all of Thomas and Jesse's messages, or rather Thomas and Mary's messages, just trying to piece together this wild love triangle and find the evidence that they need to charge him with Brian's murder. And what they find in all of this digital evidence is really disturbing. From the messages, they learn that 3 people, Thomas, Brian, and Mary, met in a chat room on the popular gaming website Pogo back in May of 2005. Thomas and Mary, posing as Jesse, were partial to teen chat rooms. Mary, or well, I guess I should say Jesse, started a conversation with Thomas, who went by the name Tommy. Soon they started messaging each other privately and appeared to get super close, like really quick. According to another article, Jesse said she was in high school and getting ready to graduate, and Thomas said that he was preparing to go off to boot camp and become a Marine. According to their messages, things were sexual between the two of them from day one, with Jesse always sending explicit photos, and the two engaging in cyber sex. And I'm sure you're wondering just like I was, how on God's green earth did she get these photos to begin with? Because if you remember, it's actually her mom doing this. As investigators are going through them, they think that Mary would take these pictures of her daughter while she wasn't looking. I mean, they said it's clear that the real Jesse had no idea what was going on. And there are multiple photos of her in uncompromising positions, like in a swimsuit, changing, and there's even a video taken up her skirt that she obviously didn't take. Her mother, y'all. This is absolutely disgusting. The two exchanged thousands of messages for almost a year, and Thomas concocted this whole story about graduating boot camp and then being shipped to Iraq, sometime messaging back and forth until 6 in the morning. And Tommy, the real Thomas, would get off when he had to go to work. But all of Thomas's lies came crashing down around him in March of 06.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're
Country Roads Creeps.
We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Sources differ on exactly how his wife found out, but she did, and she sent Jesse a letter along with a photo of her family. In the letter, she told Jesse everything that Thomas was 46, he was married, and they had two kids together. She said the only partially true thing about his identity was being a Marine. He had been in the Marines when he was younger, but that was years ago. In her messages to Thomas after receiving this letter, Jesse was devastated and went to Brian for comfort. Since all three of them played the same game, they were in the same chat rooms. Jesse had learned that Thomas and Brian were together, so their first few messages were mostly Jesse talking about Thomas and asking about Thomas. She told Brian what happened. Brian was upset for her, and they struck up a friendship. But the friendship quickly turned into something more, and Jesse started sending him photos too, and soon they became intimate online. But according to Thomas, messages from Jesse were right back in his inbox 2 weeks later. She told him that she was with Brian now, and they kind of made up. Jesse would say things like, "Don't let Tommy die." But eventually they decided to go their separate ways. And it seems like that would be the end of it. But after this wild goodbye, Jesse and Brian took to the chat rooms and exposed Thomas for who he was, and all of their allegations got him suspended from playing on Pogo. And it's at this point Brian told all of his coworkers about Thomas's lies as well. Once he exposed Thomas, his messages to Jesse got increasingly vitriolic. But there were some really bizarre moments in between these messages, where their conversation flips to being very sexual. Jesse even says things like, "You and only you are my connection to Tommy, and I will love him till the day I die." Which I guess it's her saying, even though Thomas's gaming name, Tommy, doesn't exist, she's still in love with him. It's just so bizarre for me. But in later messages to Jesse, they find more evidence that makes him more certain than ever that he was the one who killed Brian. He repeatedly messaged her threatening Brian's life, saying things like, "He made a very deadly enemy. I hate him with a passion, and for 10 cents I would eliminate him. Brian will pay in blood." He also claimed to have almost killed Brian before, and came really close to pulling the trigger. Thomas also threatened Jesse in the days leading up to the murder, saying, "You will pay now, bitch. You better be very afraid now. I told you what would happen if you and Brian got together." Eventually, Jesse stops messaging completely, and he continued asking if she was online and following up with name-calling and expletives when she didn't respond. Once they read through all of the messages on his computer, the investigators get another warrant. This time, for Mary's computer. They find all of the same messages that were on Thomas and Brian's account, but they also uncovered some other really unsettling details. It turns out that Thomas and Brian weren't the only two she was talking to. There are multiple other teenagers and young adults that she had been chatting with, and she sent the same photos of her daughter to those guys as well. Even though all of these messages paint a picture of two people who were clearly toxic, they can't charge him with murder, based on some angry messages. But that's when they finally get a break, because Forensic Labs has results from the evidence that was found around Brian's car. DNA found on the Peach Pit comes back as a match to Thomas. According to the Tall Hot Blonde documentary, they're also able to connect him to the gun clip. The last thing they need to solidify their case against Thomas is the murder weapon. But despite numerous searches of his house, they cannot find a .30 caliber rifle. But they do find proof that Thomas lied about owning one. In one of their searches, they came across a photo of his wife sitting in front of their open gun cabinet, the same one they still owned. And wouldn't you know it, sitting in the gun cabinet is an M1A. The 30 caliber rifle he told his co-workers that he would use to kill someone. Once they have this photo, in addition to all of the other evidence they have gathered, Thomas is arrested on November 24th. He's charged with second-degree murder and faces a minimum of 25 years for Brian's murder. The investigators also fill him in on Jesse's true identity, which shocked him, just as much as it did everyone else. Initially, he pleads not guilty, but according to reporting by the Buffalo News, he accepts a plea deal after a few days and pleads guilty to first-degree manslaughter, which carries a sentence of 20 years. But he actually tries to take back his guilty plea a few days later, saying that his lawyer basically wasn't truthful with him, that he wanted to go to trial. He says he has an alibi, and his daughters, who are 13 and 15 by this time, will testify for him, but the judge does not allow for this, and he is sentenced to 20 years in prison. One of the most frustrating parts of this case to me is that Mary was never charged with anything because she technically never committed a crime, which is what they say, even though she was responsible for deceiving both Thomas and Brian. Not to mention the thing that I think is actually the crime. She took multiple pictures of her daughter and sent them without consent. Her daughter and husband didn't find out until all of the court proceedings started happening. In fact, Jesse, the real Jesse, who looked for answers after her friend started making comments about it. Even though Mary wasn't charged with anything, both her family and Brian's family believe that she is just as culpable for this murder. She and her husband got a divorce, and she and her daughter no longer speak to one another. Which, who's to blame Jesse for that? This whole situation tore three families apart and resulted in the death of a young man who had so much to look forward to. We'll be back next week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find a good West Virginia true crime podcast. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries. Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com. For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.